7 a.m. meeting. My name is Lisa, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org desperately in need will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. So I had met Jeff a long time ago here at NABA. We're dinosaurs. Been around a long time. And he's always been a nice, humble guy. And so I asked him to come share his experience, strength, and hope.
Thanks, Lisa. I'm Jeff, and I'm an alcoholic. And Lisa was here when I got here. My sobriety date's February 14th, '94. She was here when I got here, and I still see her here, and that's all. It makes me feel good to see someone that's been here from the beginning. And because there are a lot of people, you know, move or go back out or whatever, you lose track of them. But when you see someone that you first got sober with, it's a good feeling. And grateful that she asked me to tell my story. Some people say come up here and they're all dressed up. For me, this T-shirt's more appropriate: grave emotional and mental disorders. But we do have the capacity to recover if we have the capacity to be honest. And right off the bat, I have to apologize to Lisa for lying. She asked me my home group, and I told her it was the Wednesday Nighters, and it used to be, but I stopped. I still go there, but I stopped being an active member of it, so I just kind of, I still go to it, but I'm not a member of it anymore. So right now, I don't have a home group. And why I didn't tell Lisa that, I don't know. But, you know, but, you know, when I first got here, you know, I thought, you know, my biggest problem was drinking. And, boy, was I wrong, you know. And I didn't realize how much of an honesty problem I had. You know, I heard stuff about catcher's honesty, and that really pissed me off. But that's about what it was for me. And so I guess I'm going to tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. Hopefully I'll find some sort of balance. So if I get this deer in the headlight look and I just shoot out that door, you know, I'm practicing one of my old character defects, you know, fear of people. And so I remember the second year I was sober, I went back to tech school and I took a technical writing course, and we had to do a speech. And I drove to school that day, and I drove around, and I said, "Shit, I just can't do it," you know. So but the following day I went to the teacher, and I was about to flare out, you know. I just didn't go, and I take the class over again, and she said, "Oh, no problem, you know. Just there's someone else that missed it, and we'll just do it next week." And so I do the speech, and my voice is quivering, I'm shaking, and there's three of us there, you know. And I get done with the speech, and she says, asked, is there any questions? He's just this, she just says, one, when are you going to pass out, you know? So, but apparently I've gotten over that a little bit. So, but you may wish I had, I could just run out of here if it gets too boring. So, anyways, I was born in Lansing, Michigan. I'm a damn Yankee. My dad is a salesman, and my mom was a nursery school teacher, and there was four of us kids. And I thought a pretty good upbringing or whatever, and lived there for about 10 years. And I thought nothing out of the ordinary happened there. I enjoyed it. The 10 years I was there. But my mom said something to me that she was always worried about me because I always played alone. And I thought I had friends and did stuff. But, you know, I guess if there was anybody around, I had no problem of entertaining myself. And so that just brings home to the point that I don't have an honest perception of who I am and how I relate to other people in this world. And that didn't come till I didn't really understand that till I got here and started doing the steps. By the way, so moved to the Chicago area after that, one of the things I remember is my mom signed me up for Little League baseball, and she had to drag me to where everybody was. I didn't want to go for something about, I guess, the fear of people. Ran deep with me, but she did, and it was the best thing that ever happened to me. I made friends, and for at least 3 or 4 years, I had a pretty normal childhood. From like 10 to about 14 or so, and played sports and ran around with the neighborhood guys and just enjoyed being a kid. In freshman in high school, I met a friend, and he introduced me to smokable alcohol, and, you know, it's an AA meeting, so I'm just going to leave it at that, you know. And the reason I bring that up is because that was the first thing that really worked for me. I remember we were walking across the high school lawn, and I was laughing, and I felt like I had this plastic film over me, and I was breaking it off, and it was kind of like, you know, I could be myself, you know. That's what drugs and alcohol did for me. And it was actually in a term to be, I did anything that anybody put in front of me but really was alcohol, because alcohol, I love the feeling that alcohol produced. You know, that's why I drank, and it made me feel I could be around you guys and be okay with being who I was. And that's always been my struggle, being around you guys and being okay with who I am. And so, I end up moving down here when I was 15, and that was a culture shock. This was in 72, and I really didn't like it very much. Went to Wheeler High School up in Marietta, and I immediately fell into the friends that drank and drugged a lot, and that's what I did. I managed to score well enough in my SATs and get to the University of Georgia. I actually took my SATs hungover. That's generally what I did, you know, and I was really kind of looking forward to going to college because the guys I hung around with really weren't interested in studying or anything, and so it was my first really experience of geographical care, and so I went to the University of Georgia with the assumption that I'd get away from those guys, I would, I could do better in school and pursue the things I wanted to do. But the problem was I took me with me. And, I started out great there, and a year and a half later, I was going down to the average, I found people that drank and drugged like me. One thing that kind of sticks out with me is that I really enjoyed shooting pool, but the pool rooms or billiard rooms in Athens at the time, they didn't allow you to drink, and so even though I was good at it, I didn't go there because I would hang out with my friends and drink. They would play foosball. I hated foosball, But, there is alcohol there. So it's just another example of me putting alcohol in front of everything else. After I took a summer job after my first two semesters, and then with the intention of going back, even though my grades had slipped. But I had an older sister, and she was moving out to Colorado, and that really sounded like a better idea. So I ended up just working and saving my money and moving out to Colorado and not going back to school. I figured, I'd go back later in my life when I was more ready for it. And didn't realize, it was the alcohol. But, so I moved out to Colorado when I was 21. One of the things that happened before I moved out there was that about my drinking is that one of the things that I did was there's this place called Rose's Cantina. Back in the 70s, late 70s, and they had bands there. I mean, I saw Greg Allman there, and the place was a blast. And I went there with a couple friends one time, and we're getting ready to leave. We're in the parking lot, and he pulls out a joint and says, let's smoke a joint. And I said, well, no, I'm good, And I says, come on, let's twist my arm. Okay, No, okay. And he smoked that joint. Next thing I remember is waking up and Grady handcuffed to a wheelchair. And I got about, probably less than a mile down Spring Street and ran to a telephone pole and put my friend into him and his girlfriend. His girlfriend didn't come out too bad, but my friend was in the hospital for 2 months. Being a good alcoholic, I had a resentment towards him because he made me smoke that joint. You would think that I would think that I had some sort of problem with alcohol, but I did have to take this alcohol course or something like that, and I lied all the way through it, and so that's the only thing I remember about that. I hired a lawyer, and he got me off of being drunk at the scene of an accident. So. This is the 70s. That's I didn't like blacking out. I did my best to control my drinking, or I wouldn't black out. I just, you know, had that experience. But, you know, I just kept on drinking and doing what I did. And moved to Colorado and met up with my sister and lived with my sister for a little while. And kind of just floated, you know, just did my thing, you know, worked in a restaurant out there and drank and whatever. At this one restaurant I worked at, I met these guys that they were in AA, except they were kind of in and out, you know. And and they were a blast to drink with. And so we would just, you know, they say, no, we're not drinking. And, you know, come on, let's go drinking. Because they were just they were a lot of fun. And so we get into drink and, you know, felt bad. You know, once I got into AA, I felt bad. But, they were in the spot where, you know, they couldn't see drinking. They couldn't see life with or without drinking. So, you know, it was, and we didn't mean anything by it, but that's what we did. And I eventually went back to I decided I wanted to go back to technical school worked in two jobs 7 days a week and going to school, and I still managed to go to the bar every night. And I got a job in electronics business, and my drinking started increasing. At one point I woke up one morning and I kind of fucked up at work. Screwed up at work, pardon the French, and I decided I didn't want to go to work, and so I poured myself a highball and started drinking, and called my boss and said, you know, I'm sitting here, I decided I'd rather drink than go into work. And he tells me. Put that shit down, you know. We'll get you some help, you know. But I didn't think I had a problem. I just didn't want to go to work. But that was kind of beginning of the end for me. I pretty soon, at first I started looking for jobs, and then I started drinking earlier and earlier, and then pretty soon I was from morning to evening, and I did that for a while, and it was getting kind of scary because, you know, I was kind of running out of money, and then this is kind of how God works in my life. I said, well, you know, I need to get a haircut and clean myself up, and so I went over to this lady who cuts my hair, and she saw how much a wreck I was, and she says, well, you know, I'm an AA, and I know, you know, you're in really bad shape. You know, I can give you this address, the detox center, and we can get you to meetings and stuff like that. I ain't ready for that shit. You know, I really just want to drink. You know, that's all I want to do. But it was just one of those coincidences, you know. She's an AA, you know, I didn't even know it, you know. But eventually, you know, I got to a point where I know I got to do something about this, and so I ended up going to this alcohol counselor, and she wanted me to go to this treatment center for like a year, and a fucking year. You know, I can't take a year out of my life. You know, what the hell is this shit? He says, well, what I can do is I can try working with you and send you AA meetings and put you on antabuse. And so, you know, she just started working the steps with me, and it's got me on antabuse. I was starting to go to meetings, and remember in these meetings, there's this, told me about this one guy. He had a house in Denver, and he sold the house and moved to Phoenix, and all he did was sit in the bar and drink from morning to night. And I go, what a fucking dumb fuck, you know. Well, basically, I'm getting a little ahead of myself. Basically, what I am doing is selling my house in Denver and going to Florida and drinking up all the profits of my house. And so, you know, what the fucking dumb fuck. You know, I see it, I spot it, I got it. And so, by the way, after about 30 days, I hadn't been without drinking for 30 days and since I was a teenager. So something special is going on here, you know. But I got this obsession to drink, and when I had to drink, I drank on antabuse, and I suggest nobody ever try doing that, because I don't think I've ever been as sick. I've never been as sick as drinking on antabuse, and then I figured I failed. So I drank, so I failed, so I stopped going to outpatient counselor and AA, and then it was kind of weird. Then I could, just when I started drinking again, it was just at night, and I could handle that. And I got this job and working for the Veterans of the Homeless, which would kind of be a precursor of what was going to happen to me. And working there during the day and just drinking at night, I was like, shit, I got this handle. I guess the big relief, I'm not an alcoholic, you know, I'm good to go. So I sell my house and moved to Florida and drink everything up, and then become homeless because no one wants anything to do with me. Oh God, that was a miserable experience. When I became homeless, I knew it just wasn't going to get any better than this. I can't describe the words when I became homeless, and I just wanted to die, but I couldn't. And so I just ended up doing the homeless thing for a while, and then one of these, what I call a God thing, happened, and my grandmother fell and broke her hip, and somehow my parents got word hold of me, and I ended up coming back up to here in Marietta and getting a roof over my head, and so I visit her, and that's when I hit my bottom. That's when I had a roof over my head, and I said, fuck, you know, because when I was homeless, I figured if I got a roof over my head, you know, things would be okay. But I got the roof over my head, and I realized, you know, it wasn't. And I said, you know, I just can't do this alone anymore. I need help. And when that thought passed, that really scared me to my core, because I figured, you know, I'm going to have to stop drinking. But I worked through those fears and ended up in a treatment center, going to a treatment center, and they sent me here. When I took that action, I didn't realize that at the time, but the obsession to drink was lifted from me. And it took me probably three months before I realized, you know, I haven't been thinking about drinking. But I wasn't a happy camper because I realized, you know, not drinking wasn't enough. The nice thing about the recovery center, I'm not recommending it or anything, but for me it worked, and it was because I was with other people that were trying to do the same thing. And so, you know, it gave me a safety net. If I drank, you know, I was out. So it was, that worked for me. So I started coming to meetings, and I kept on waiting for someone to tell me how not to drink, because when I, you know, as I said, when I had to drink bad. And, but, you know, I, for some reason, you know, I was going to meetings, and I didn't have to drink, and I kind of had this thought came through my mind, you know, as long as I wanted to stay sober, I was probably going to have to go to meetings. So I made a decision to, you know, kind of like the third step, made a decision and started to enjoy going to meetings. And I've been enjoying going to meetings ever since. And I found out, you know, I cannot get sober and stay sober without you guys. I can't do it alone. And at this point, you know, and the more I'm coming around, the more I'm glad I can't do this by myself. You know, it's so fulfilling meeting all you alcoholics. I kind of like us alcoholics. I think we're a little bit twisted in a good way, and especially when we aren't drinking. And I enjoy us. So I started going to meetings and realized, you know, not drinking wasn't enough. And I kept on saying, get a sponsor. And so I end up, there's this 5:45 meeting here, and there's this guy who's just got, at the time they had a sponsor list where you could call somebody and ask them to be your sponsor or something like that. So I, after the meeting, I go up and ask the chairperson about the sponsor list, and he thought I was asking him to be my sponsor. No, I wasn't, but yeah, whatever, you know. So he took me under his arms and took me out to his car to give me some reading material, and so I was driving a beat up old VW bus, and he was ripping roofs off old houses and going to school. And for some reason, that was okay. Because I saw a lot of people with nice cars and everything, but for me, sometimes things, I understand things backwards from the way other people get it. When I was homeless, I had this revelation, you know, I was miserable when I had a house and friends and a job and everything. I'm here homeless. I don't have anything. I'm still fucking miserable. So I guess it's not material stuff that that has anything to do with my happiness. So when I met my sponsor, I said, "Well, you know, it's not the physical things that's going to make me happy. It's got to be the steps or something." So it kind of hit home with me, and to me, the steps are just—it's the most amazing process that I've ever come across. I mean, I would not still be here without the steps, like the first step, I guess. I realized, going through the steps with the sponsor, you know, takes it from my head to the heart, you know, being powerless over alcohol and our lives becoming unmanageable. It takes that down to my heart, and I understand it down to my soul that I'm powerless over this stuff. And the second step, to me, the second step is to a certain extent, it's one of my favorite steps, because without the second step, I don't feel I can do the rest of the steps. You know, I had to come to terms that there was a power greater than myself. You know, there's a story in the beginning of the big book, I think, that talks about this son of a preacher or something like that, and he says, who am I to say there's no God? And I remember reading that one time and looking, sitting outside and looking at the stars, and I say, who am I to say there's no God? And I could, and for me it was a biggie, because I could go on with the rest of the steps. And the third step, you know, my sponsor let me struggle with that, because I had no idea how to do that. How do I turn my will and my life over to the care of a power greater than myself that I just said that I came to believe that there might be, you know, something bigger than me, and how would I do that? And then finally, at the end of the third step, says, you go on to step four. And I could do that. I was ready to let go of that shit. You know? And so I did step four, and I did step five with my sponsor. And for me, there's a whole new, put a whole new awareness of how my life was unmanageable. You know, it's because of my character defects. We're also talking a little bit about a meeting last night and about my emotional. I've met the enemy, and the enemy is me. I had no control of my emotions, and you know, I was a victim to my emotions. And with the steps, I learned how to. I am learning still how, you know, I've been coming around since 94. I'm still learning how to deal with my emotions. And it's a day-to-day thing. But it's gratifying. So, you know, in six and seven, you know, they say that the growth steps. For me, I became a human being with six and seven, you know. I no longer had to do things perfect. You know, I can make mistakes as long as I try to learn from them. And also, in a strange way, made me feel closer to you, because being a good judgmental alcoholic, I can see my defects in me, and I can see my defects in you. And so it kind of you know, makes us one and the same, makes us human. Yeah, that's a cool experience. To me, that was a cool revelation. I became a human being. I remember, actually, I can't remember. So anyways, the ninth, eighth and ninth step, I burned a lot of bridges, I burned a lot of bridges, when I did the eighth and ninth step, I realized I could go anywhere in the world again. It opened me up to the world. And you know, 10, 11, 12 are the maintenance step. I keep coming back. I like what I get, so I keep coming. Sobriety's been giving me a lot of gifts, I've met some people. I've a lot of people in these programs. Some I've met a couple people that have died. You know, died from this disease. I remember a friend I met. In these rooms, I think we were going to like the 1:30 meeting. It was back when it was a smoking meeting, and we started hanging around and driving by these apartments. And this was probably when I was like 4 or 5 years sober, and driving by these apartments, I said, you know, I was in a halfway house in those apartments. And he said, me too. So when? And we were at the same time, except for he was. he was there only for about 2 weeks or something like that, and then they put him, then they took him to, then he had to go to prison for a year or so, you know, that was just one of the cool things. We had gotten sober together, but we didn't realize that we met in these rooms. He ended up going back out after about 10 years or so, and he died from this disease. That hurt. It pissed me off. What happens when people go back out, it pisses me off, then I get an empty feeling, and then it just hurts, you know, and then it just... But, you know, that's part of this disease, you know. And about 10 years sober, I went to this, used to go to this 11-step retreat, and it was at the Jesuit Center in Sandy Springs. I got involved in the meeting to set up one time, and they asked me to tell my story, and I was feeling pretty good, and I get back home, and my mom calls me, and she says, you know, she starts saying something about Robin, and Robin was my older sister, and I knew she didn't even have to say anything that Robin died, and she was only 51 at the time, it was a shock, and I went through, and I didn't have to drink over it, and it was a strange experience. I understood, went through the grieving process, but it was pretty hard. And also, I guess I kind of melted down too. I quit my job, I quit school. I was going to Southern Tech, and I quit both my job and school, and just started helping a friend doing remodeling stuff. But I went through the grieving process with her, and I remember I was feeling a loss. I remember hearing people talk about when they, you know. I realized, you know, I never did a formal men's with her. You know, I kind of did a living with men's with her, and that kind of bothered me. I never did a formal men's with her. I heard people say, you know, they write a letter to her, and letter to the people who passed, and so that's what I did with her. And it turned into a thank you letter for her being in my life, and that was really gratifying. And so that's another blessing that, another way this program helped me through living life on life's terms, and sobriety's just been good. I could never hold a job more than 5 years, and then my character defects would just build up, and I just end up leaving. I just quit, you know. Generally without notice or anything, I just quit. In sobriety, I learned how to keep a job. This job I've been doing, I've been doing for about 15 years now, and enjoy it, and it's been good. Right now, I have my mom is 96, and she's in an assisted living center here. Yeah, it is a long time, and she's an assisted living center here in Marietta, and she's suffering from dementia for the most part. It's tough. It's a lot of times, like after going and visiting her, I feel like crying. But you know, I guess I'm there for her. I have a brother who's in South Carolina, and so he's farther away from it, and I have a sister that lives in Alaska, and so we all have our jobs about, you know, taking care of my mom, and we all do something for her in our own ways, and we don't have any resentments towards each other, and it's a good thing. So, but that's where I'm at. I'm kind of, maybe God's telling us that that's enough. So I'm glad I was asked to do this. But you know, Lisa asked me a couple months ago, and I'm more than ready to hit. When I came in this afternoon, I was more than ready to get this done. So thanks for asking me, and thanks for listening, and happy Fourth, guys.
Thank you very much. It was touching because, like you said, we met in here. We hadn't really stayed in whole close touch, but it's just beautiful to see like how people evolve with this program. It's just, you're so cool. I'm so glad that you're in recovery with me, my brother. Yeah.
Strange to me, as I rode from town to town, can't put the bottle down, right now feels like it's killing me. Life out here gets so depressing, need something to take the edge, you see. It's the bottle, the book, or the gun for me. Seems like everyone's out to get me. Trouble always following me. Feeling like I just can't outrun. Demon saddle.